It is Wednesday, November 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump promises major sanctions in response to North Korea's latest missile test. Another prominent public figure loses his job following an accusation of sexual impropriety. And a small U.S. town rediscovers its amazing history. It's all ahead. North Korea Wednesday said it successfully launched a new intercontinental ballistic missile, the Hwasong-15, that carried what a KRT newsreader called a super-large heavy warhead capable of hitting all the U.S. mainland. The KRT newsreader also said leader Kim Jong-un declared the North has finally realized the great historic cause of completing what he called the state nuclear force. Pyongyang said the ICBM reached an altitude of nearly 4,500 kilometers and a distance of nearly 1,000 kilometers before falling within Japan's exclusive economic zone. It was the first missile test since mid-September and the first to follow new U.S. sanctions and relisting the North as a state sponsor of terrorism. President Donald Trump, briefed on the launch, vowed again to take care of it, a situation he said we will handle. Trump said major sanctions will be imposed on North Korea. In a tweet Wednesday, President Trump said he spoke with Chinese President Xi Jinping about the provocative actions of North Korea. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis also commented.
They went higher, frankly, than any previous shot they've taken. It's a research and development effort on their part to continue building ballistic missiles that could threaten everywhere in the world, basically. But the bottom line is it's a continued effort to build a threat, sir, a ballistic missile threat that endangers world peace, regional peace, and certainly the United States.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said diplomatic options remain viable and open for now. South Korean President Moon Jae-in warned the situation could spiral out of control if Pyongyang perfects its ICBM technology. Senior RAND Corporation defense researcher Bruce Bennett tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, outside analysis will have to determine the weight of the warhead. He said missiles are sensitive to the payload. If it was just a couple hundred kilograms, it might not reach most targets with a nuclear warhead. Bennett also spoke about the length of time that elapsed from the last test.
What one has to wonder is, with all of the statements that the U.S. had made in the August and September timeframe, how seriously was Kim Jong-un intimidated by that? Did he really worry that if he continued on his fast pace of activities, that the U.S. might take a military action? Even now, what President Trump is saying, nobody really knows. He might try a military action. But Kim had focused in August and September on the Ulchi Freedom Guardian exercise that the U.S. and South Korean military do in Korea, and was trying to say, I want to go with the Chinese approach of you canceling your exercises and I'll cancel my missile tests. And when the U.S. refused to do that, he then tested several missiles and a nuclear weapon to punish us for not being prepared to compromise. I think after all of that, he probably felt that he'd pushed the U.S. and South Korea as hard as he could for a while, and he'd better back off in order not to get himself into some real trouble.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said he's not giving up on a diplomatic solution to this situation, but is time running out?
The U.S. would clearly prefer a diplomatic solution. The question is, where's Kim Jong-un headed? If his objective is only regime survival, only to protect his regime, he's demonstrated plenty of capability that he could cause us some harm, he probably doesn't need a whole lot more in the way of missile tests. But if his objective is to go to some form of nuclear warfighting where he could seriously threaten the U.S. and South Korea, then he likely would need to continue the testing he's been doing this year. So I would say over the next few months, we're going to have a pretty clear indication of what his objective is.
That's Bruce Bennett of the RAND Corporation. DefensePriorities.org senior fellow Danny Davis said he believes Kim Jong-un's objective is a defensive nuclear deterrence against U.S. threats, not an offensive capability he knows will only invite a catastrophic military response. It is time now for social media. Well, one of the biggest news stories of the day is the firing of longtime Today Show host Matt Lauer by NBC News. NBC News Chairman Andy Lack said in a statement on Monday night, "We received a detailed complaint from a colleague about inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace by Matt Lauer. It represented, after serious review, a clear violation of our company's standards. As a result, we've decided to terminate his employment." Lauer has worked at the network for more than 20 years. Well, one of the first to comment was President Donald Trump. He tweeted, "Wow, Matt Lauer was just fired from NBC for inappropriate sexual behavior in the workplace." But, the president continued to tweet, "When will the top executives at NBC and Comcast be fired for putting out so much fake news? Check out Andy Lack's past." Well, we will have more on this story later in the program. And that's a look at social media for today. Here are some of the top news stories that we are following. President Trump is touting a tax overhaul in a speech in Missouri. Former Bosnian Croat military commander dies after drinking poison in a Hague courtroom. President Trump retweets inflammatory anti-Muslim videos. And a Zimbabwe pastor and activist found not guilty of subversion. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scottish researchers think life on Earth may have originated from biological particles that were sent in high-speed streams of interplanetary space dust. Similar flows of possible life-laden dust may also be traveling from our planet to others in the solar system. The new study from scientists from the University of Edinburgh proposes that dust streams with possible alien organisms could collide with biological particles in Earth's atmosphere with enough energy to knock them into space, send them traveling to other worlds in our solar system or perhaps in others. The researchers say their new findings suggest that large asteroid impacts may not be the only way that life-giving material can transfer between planets, as was previously thought. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a town in Pennsylvania rediscovers its past. The U.S. television network NBC has fired its leading morning news anchor Matt Lauer after receiving a complaint against him describing sexual misconduct. Lauer is the latest prominent U.S. personality to face allegations of long-running sexual abuse. The list includes President Donald Trump, former President Bill Clinton when he was in office in the 1990s, actor Bill Cosby, film producer Harvey Weinstein, journalists and corporate executives. About 16 women have accused Trump of sexual harassment or worse. He's labeled the accusations fake news in both online tweets and other statements. Meg Bond is the director of the Center for Women and Work at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. She tells me her reaction to the recent firings involving Matt Lauer, as well as to that of CBS and PBS journalist Charlie Rose.
What's really surprising is just that it's starting to spill out. Not surprising is exactly what you said. This has been going on for a very long time, and in fact, probably the majority of women, research shows, that the majority of women have experienced something in the form of sexual harassment throughout their work lives. So to have it finally come to light is really the change that has emerged, not the fact that this has been going on.
Well, was the most a recent case involved Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. That seemed, in a way, to launch a lot of this, although I guess you could also say the charges in the court case involving comedian Bill Cosby also got a lot of people to look at this issue.
Yes, and the Weinstein case really seemed to unleash the reports that have come out, the kinds of things that have emerged in social media, but I think it's been in the air for a while, and I think we can also link it back to a lot of what happened during the presidential campaign in terms of the kinds of sexist comments and beliefs and the accusations against our president brought out that this behavior has been going on for a long time, a lot of men in power, and that it's been tolerated, and I think there's a level of frustration that probably has been brewing, and it just needed that tipping point to see that there was a way to come forward, and that social media has provided something that we never had before in terms of a place where it's become safe through the Me Too campaign and through the high-profile cases that are now getting taken seriously by organizational leaders and industry leaders who are willing to take some kind of action.
Certainly, looking back at the presidential campaign, there was that Access Hollywood tape of now President Trump. This was a number of years ago. He wasn't president then, but he was speaking, and he made highly inappropriate comments about women. But there was also, during the campaign, Trump brought out three women who had accused in the past of former President Bill Clinton of sexual impropriety as well. So this very much goes to, it's both political parties.
Oh, absolutely. And this kind of behavior, really, it has its roots in deep societal values about women, and those do not line up along party lines. That we have a deep socialization around how women are valued in our society and what their appropriate roles are, and a lot of it has focused on women as objects and available to men as sexual beings versus thinking about women as and treating women as competent people, valued for their skills and expertise. So the problems run very, very deep, and really if we want to shift this, we're probably talking about the need to socialize our children in a different way around gender roles and attitudes towards women. And that depth of the problem means that this is not a simple political issue or that it lines up along any kinds of party lines. It's a broad-based issue. So if you look at the research, it's kind of interesting because some folks focus on reports of sexual harassment, but we know from research that, well, some of the studies say 70%, others say 90% of women who experience sexual harassment never report it, never even talk to a supervisor, much less report it in some kind of formal way. So this has been a broad-based problem experienced by women across class, across race, ethnicity, for a very long time. And it simply hasn't had the receptivity or the sense that at least some women are feeling safe coming out, and that's what's new.
Well, and I think in this latest case of Matt Lauer, apparently there have been some investigations going on by the New York Times and I guess Variety magazine were looking into this anyway. And certainly the New York Times.
The media has been incredibly important in giving voice to women who haven't been believed before, who've been dismissed, who've been either subtly or even more blatantly marginalized whenever they raise a concern. I applaud the press for what they've done to make it okay and at least safe for some people. I mean, I think there are a lot of people, women, who still don't feel safe raising their concerns because they're worried about not being believed, they're worried about the backlash, they're worried about being ostracized. But the media has played a tremendously helpful role in allowing women's voices to be heard, and I'm very grateful to the press for taking this issue so seriously.
Meg Bond, the director of the Center for Women and Work at the University of Massachusetts at Lowell. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A dedicated teacher and her students are discovering that their small hometown of Cheltenham, Pennsylvania, played a surprisingly large role in U.S. history. Over the centuries, it was a refuge for a religious minority, a training ground for an army that fought against slavery, and home to a financier who raised huge sums to pay for the Civil War. Jan Sluzer reports Cheltenham's story was a surprise to people who spent all their lives in the community and graduated from Cheltenham High School.
Teacher Lisa Marlowe grew up in Cheltenham, graduated from Cheltenham High, and taught in a local school for 10 years before she learned about Cheltenham's 335-year-long history.
Never heard of Camp William Penn. Never heard of African-American soldiers training here. I never heard that Lucretia Mott was this famous abolitionist lady who lived here. I wasn't taught that Frederick Douglass was here, that Harriet Tubman was here, that William Steele was here, William Lloyd Garrison, Robert Purvis. And here I am teaching social studies.
Marlowe introduced this unknown history to her students. Together, they wrote a book called Back in Time with Cheltenham and made a movie. When Cheltenham High School's class of 1967 held its 50th reunion, Marlowe took alumni on a tour of places where they grew up, starting with the Richard Wall House. Wall left Cheltenham, England, with Quakers in 1682, seeking religious freedom in the American colony of Pennsylvania. He named their new settlement Cheltenham after their old town. Wall's home soon became a Quaker meeting house.
The coolest thing about the Wall House is that it's one of the very first places in the nation where they talked about ending slavery in 1688.
Almost two centuries later, during the Civil War, Cheltenham took another step against slavery. Nearby Philadelphia's large African-American population made it a logical place to train segregated units for the Union Army. But Philadelphia was also home to many Southern sympathizers, and city officials worried there'd be riots.
They wanted to move it outside of Philadelphia. So who's that? That's us, right? Cheltenham Avenue, right, is the border of Philadelphia and Cheltenham. So all that land on the other side of Cheltenham Avenue was Lucretia Mott's land. Now, we know she was a Quaker, very against war, but she understood why black men wanted to fight and end slavery.
Mott was a leader in the anti-slavery movement, so she leased her land to the federal government for $1, and Camp William Penn was built there.
11,000 men trained here. 40% were slaves. They were sent to find Abraham Lincoln's assassins. They were at the surrender of Lee in Virginia. They were the only black troops to carry Lincoln's casket when he was killed. And when you read a Civil War book, could be 2,000 pages long, there's no mention of them. They were 12% of the army.
America's first investment banker, Jay Cook, built his mansion in Cheltenham, not far from Camp William Penn, and his good friend, Lucretia Mott. On January 1, 1861, a few months before the start of the Civil War, Cook opened a private banking house in Philadelphia and soon became involved in selling bonds to finance the Pennsylvania militia. He was so successful, the federal government asked him to sell bonds for the Union Army, Jay Cook is known as the financier of the Civil War.
General Grant, who came here to Cheltenham, said that the Civil War would never have been won without Jay Cook. He raised over $1 billion worth of U.S. war bonds. It was his idea to create war bonds to finance the war.
In the modern era, Cheltenham High School produced some well-known names. Baseball great Reggie Jackson was in the class of 1964, and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu graduated in 1967, although he didn't make the 50th reunion. Everyone who did knew about those alumni, but until they took Lisa Marlowe's tour, no one knew anything about the history of the place where they grew up. Alumni Alan Monheit sees the old neighborhood with new eyes.
I didn't appreciate all these things we have right in our backyard. To learn about the history of Lucretia Mott, that we saw that, I mean, we're just probably scratching the surface. Such a gorgeous area, the history about the abolition and the Civil War. Just fascinating. I didn't really know any of this.
December 6 marks the anniversary of the 1865 ratification of the U.S. Constitution's 13th Amendment, abolishing slavery. Thanks to Lisa Marlowe, many now know the role some of Cheltenham's leading residents played in making that happen. For VOA News, this is Jan Sluzer in Cheltenham, Pennsylvania.
And that is our show for today. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Robert Mugabe resigned the presidency of Zimbabwe last week after Parliament initiated impeachment proceedings against him, ending his oppressive 37-year rule and opening the country to what U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson called an extraordinary opportunity to set itself on a new path. Mugabe was elected as Zimbabwe's first prime minister in 1980 and became president in 1987 after changes to the constitution created an executive presidency. He had remained in power ever since. During his rule, the United States condemned his government's increasing assault on human rights and the rule of law and joined much of the world in calling for the government of Zimbabwe to embrace a peaceful democratic evolution. In his place, former Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in, promising the beginning of a new unfolding democracy. With the resignation of Robert Mugabe, today marks a historic moment for Zimbabwe, said Secretary Tillerson in a statement. We congratulate all Zimbabweans who raised their voices and stated peacefully and clearly that the time for change was overdue. The United States looks forward to and hopes for free and fair elections, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert.
The people of Zimbabwe have firmly voiced their desire for a new era to bring an end to Zimbabwe's isolation and allow the country to rejoin the international community. The future of Zimbabwe, though, has to be determined by the people of that country.
Secretary Tillerson also said, we urge Zimbabwe's leaders to implement much-needed political and economic reforms for a more stable and promising future for the Zimbabwean people. We will continue to support the people of Zimbabwe as these reforms move forward. U.S. Ambassador to Zimbabwe Harry Thomas noted future U.S. engagement with Zimbabwe and President Mnangagwa will depend on those actions. This is a new day. This is a new opportunity for him and his cabinet to live up to the wonderful 2013 Zimbabwean Constitution. And that is what we will tell them. It is your constitution. It is democratic. It is something you endorsed when you were Minister of Justice and later as Vice President. This is for your people. So live up to it, and the United States will find a way to partner. The United States is the largest provider of development and humanitarian assistance to the people of Zimbabwe, providing $253 million last year. The United States, said Secretary Tillerson, strongly supports a peaceful, democratic, and prosperous Zimbabwe.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.